Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we interviewed Dr. Adrian Dixon, who's the Executive Director of the Education and Civil Rights Initiative and a professor in the Educational Leadership Studies Department in the College of Education at the University of Kentucky. Dr. Dixon's research focuses on how race, class, and gender intersect and impact educational equity in urban schooling contexts. This month, we speak with Dr. Dixon about critical race theory, including its origins, how it's used in education, and where it might go in the future. So critical race theory has been in the news a lot in the past few months. So for listeners who aren't familiar with critical race theory, or CRT, as it's also commonly known, can you provide an overview of the foundational principles and objectives of critical race theory and how it emerged within the legal scholarship context?
Well, thank you for the question. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I'm really excited. So CRT, separate from education, so I'll just talk about what I know about CRT in the as a theory that then became important in education. So critical race theory scholars like Derek Bell, Charles Lawrence, Mari Matsuda, Kimberly Crenshaw, Neil Gotanda, Gary Peller. I mean, there are so many. They were concerned about or had a critique of the role that U.S. jurisprudence has had in the kind of in the continued subordination of mostly people of color, primarily people of color. And that their argument is that that U.S. jurisprudence is designed to kind of protect the elite, the powerful, and reflects white supremacist ideologies. And Derek Bell kind of came to that realization through his participation in as a litigator in the Brown decision, who specifically was assigned down in the South, in the Deep South, to get potential clients to sign on to this, to the, you know, the major lawsuit that the world-changing lawsuit of the Brown decision, the precedent-setting Brown decision. And so what he realized is that the Brown decision wasn't going to radically alter racial subordination and racism as it manifested in education policy. In fact, his argument continued to be, even after the decision, that it actually exacerbated conditions because it had the kind of imprimatur of the law, right? So we could get around, and many districts and states got around the Brown decision legally by enacting other practices that were as harmful and as segregative as legal racial segregation. And he wrote an article about this, Serving Two Masters, is that even with his kind of commitment to, at that time, racial equality, that he was more committed to the ideology of racial equality more so than to the desires of his clients. That, again, the kind of commitment to these broad and abstract ideas superseded what his clients actually wanted. And what they wanted was relief from racial subordination, but recognize, and this is where kind of his racial realism came in, recognize that they lived in the Deep South. And simply changing a law wouldn't change beliefs, deep-seated historical beliefs that people held in their core. And the kind of racial violence that they experienced on a daily basis was not going to change simply because the Supreme Court decided in their favor. So they recognized the limitations. He began to recognize the limitations of the law to provide relief for racial subordination and racial violence. It just wasn't going to happen because of a Supreme Court decision. And he recognized also, again, the way that the U.S. jurisprudence was kind of implicated in maintaining processes, and in some ways being the author of racial subordination and white supremacy. And Kimberly Crenshaw and Mari Matsuda, Charles Lawrence, all of the early architects of critical race theory recognized, again, the limitations of the law to find and to create relief for people who had experienced racial subordination. So that's kind of the context of CRT. And all of them were civil rights lawyers, again, who worked in anti-discrimination. You know, Neil Gotanda's really important piece that we don't talk enough about is about the fallacy of this notion that the Constitution is colorblind, and looking at the kind of limitations of liberal ideology or liberal theory that is the kind of guidance, you know, is the kind of foundational ideas of the law, right? And of U.S. law. And so they all, again, recognize the kind of limits, and they are the post-Brown group that Brown didn't do, and the civil rights legislation that came after Brown didn't do what they had hoped it would do. And so, but it was, in some ways, it was always a fixed game because U.S. jurisprudence just would never take that up and has been very resistant to any kind of nuances around race and racial subordination, et cetera. So that's the kind of context of critical race theory.
You mentioned that CRT has now become a prominent theory that's used in education. How did that come to be, and how has that evolved over time?
So as you know, you sit in Wisconsin. The university, so the law school convened a group of the kind of early, again, architects of CRT to kind of talk about what is this thing of critical, what are we doing? What is our critique? And how are we responding to critical legal studies and other critical examinations of the law? And so Wisconsin was kind of ground zero, a fertile place for them to kind of come together and put all that together. Gloria and Bill Tate were assistant professors at the time, and recognized too that in education, the Brown decision has not done for students of color what we had hoped it would do. In fact, schools were more segregated after the Brown decision within schools. So if you looked on paper, you would see schools would, you know, they would look diverse on paper, but when you look more closely, who were in gifted programs, who were in honors programs, who were taking the AP courses, they were predominantly white. So even within schools that on paper looked diverse, they were highly segregated at the intellectual level. And so again, this is a way of getting around Brown kind of legally, right? We have a diverse school, but the intellectual engagement, this wasn't the dream of even those families that participated in the Brown, as you know, were plaintiffs in the Brown case. This wasn't their dream to resegregate school and keep their kids again locked out of rigorous and rich opportunities to learn and et cetera. So one of their arguments was that we didn't really theorize and understand race. We used race as a variable to look at, again, outcomes and outcomes in policy and test scores, but we didn't look at race as a factor in shaping these outcomes. So they weren't arguing to make a causal argument, except that there could be something there, and we hadn't theorized on it enough in education. And so one of their arguments was that we need to look more carefully at how race informs policies and practices in K through 20 schools.
When you think about from that initial point of the work that Gloria Latson Billingston and Bill Tate did to today, you've written a lot about where we are today with CRT, the evolution in CRT and how it's been used. How has it changed?
I think that what Gloria, Bill, and even, you know, Kimberly, who's still very active as a scholar, Derek Bell has passed on. James O'Callmore was a professor at UNC Chapel Hill. He's passed on. Mari Matsuda and Charles Lawrence are now at University of Hawaii and still very active as scholars. Cheryl Harris is active. So I think what people forget is really critical analysis of systems, of policies, of practices, and then an imagining of what can happen, what we do, how do we transform, and work. We always say this notion of social change, and people think that means that we need to go out and march. No, that doesn't mean we need to go out and march. We need to imagine and enact something different. So I will say all of them, the early architects, are very active in political life and in social change efforts. Derek Bell famously engaged in hunger strikes when Harvard didn't live up to its promise of hiring an African-American woman. He engaged in open protests, particularly around his universities living up to their stated commitments. Kimberly Crenshaw has started a nonprofit organization that's very active. It's called the African American Policy Forum. And they engage in a number of, we've done listening sessions and we've held town halls and policy advocacy. So she's very active. Charles Lawrence used to sit on the, he and Mari Matsuda were at Georgetown, he sat on the school board for the DC schools and put his kids in public schools in DC. Now here he is, a professor at Georgetown and grew up very well to do. And his kids went to public schools in DC because he believed that one, his kids need to go there, but also he need to be a part of thinking about how do we make schools better. So I think that what folks forget about critical race theory is that it lays bare the way that race is used to, again, subordinate people, the relationship between race and white supremacy in education, and that we imagine something different and something new, and we try to enact something transformative. And so people merely use it as an analytical tool that doesn't really have a really strong and biting critique. It's like, oh, here's race, and you know, that's where I think we are.
we talked about how CRT has been in the news a lot in the past few months. It's faced significant criticism, but how have the critics of CRT mistaken what CRT is? Well, what are some of the misconceptions that you've heard about CRT, and how does that impact some of the broader discourse around race and equity and justice?
Well, I think the conflation with CRT with anyone or any project that talks about race, it's not. So critical race theory has a very specific critique of systems and practices and policies. And it is aligned with white supremacy. So it makes people uncomfortable. It even makes, as Gloria wrote a piece, how did a nice field like education, you know, deal with CRT or whatever, how CRT in a nice field like education. It makes people feel uncomfortable to talk about racism, to talk about racial subordination, to talk about white supremacy. Those are uncomfortable topics to have in the U.S. where we like to pretend that a lot of things don't exist. We completely erase people and their experiences and quote-unquote controversies. And so I think what people get wrong is that anyone who says race or white supremacy or LGBTQI, that they are talking about CRT, and they're not. So DEI has been lumped in with CRT. I would love for some DEI folks to actually really engage CRT, but many don't. And just because you're talking about race doesn't mean you're talking about DEIA. Culturally relevant pedagogy isn't CRT. It's a completely different thing. Yes, Gloria was a part of kind of articulating what culturally relevant pedagogy is, but it's not the same thing, and she'll tell you that. CRT isn't about killing white people. Like, we're not talking about getting rid of white people or any other group. It's again laying out it holds up a mirror to our rhetoric about equality when we're practicing in inequitable ways. And so that makes people really uncomfortable. And again, I think that is really the foundation of the kind of criticisms of CRT, is that people who hold power, and if we look at kind of who the critics are, most of them are, you know, well-to-do white folks. They don't want to feel uncomfortable. They, you know, do whatever, you know, whatever they do, they give and make donations, and they say nice, they smile when they see black children. And so how could they be racist? And so it, you know, at its core, CRT should make you uncomfortable because we're constantly holding up the mirror to our practices that are, that subordinate people, that create huge inequalities or advantages for others. So I think that's what they get wrong about CRT.
You made this distinction between CRT and how folks think CRT is involved in the process of curricular design or what happens in schools. How do you think that should be connected? You started to talk about that a little bit, but what role should CRT play, not only in how we hold this mirror up to systems and to policy design, but to the processes that happen within schools?
Well, I think that, so early on, Gloria and Bill, in their first piece toward a theory of critical race theory in education, they talked about the limitations of and the failures of multicultural education. That what started out as a critical intervention into the erasure of people of color, which was ethnic studies, from that became multicultural education. Because what folks have recognized, and they're learning this in the UK, the UK is trying to start an ethnic studies movement, and they were starting at the level of the university. Similarly, in the US back in the 60s, we, you know, scholars agitated for more ethnic studies courses at the university. And what they recognized is that students were coming through a system where they were completely erased, no discussion of people of color whatsoever. And then you get to college, and first of all, who was going to teach these classes? So it presumes that you would have faculty who are ready to teach the classes. And then you would have students who ideologically were open to learning about even themselves. And so the backup was, we need to go back to K-12. And it became watered down. And so you get foods and festivals and Taco Tuesday. And, you know, you grew up in California, so you know, I spent my early childhood in California. Whenever it was somebody's birthday at school, we had a pinata, right? And that was, you know, recognition of, right, of Mexican culture, right? And so it became really superficial. And so ideally, CRT in schools would, you'd have to have a teacher who had a consciousness. And this is kind of, Dr. Banks talked about this ecology that would support multicultural education, where you have school leaders that support the work, and you have a curriculum that looks at the thorny, uncomfortable history of the United States and our continued relationships, our foreign policy. These are uncomfortable things, and people think it makes you unpatriotic. What makes, I think, people unpatriotic is knowledge being suppressed, and then you learn something, and then you're angry because you didn't know it. And so I would love to see, so a CRT engagement curriculum would talk about the ugly history of dispossession, of black and brown, communities and peoples. So, you know, the Trail of Tears would be a much more critical, look, the even annexation of the Southwestern United States, we would talk more critically about that, and kids would understand what that, you know, looks like, and how do we talk about a border, and we hijack, you know, we took land from people, so that we would just have, you know, that we would have a deeper understanding of the, again, power, empire, and again, dispossession of peoples. And that's what's made the United States. I mean, that's just absolutely what our history is. And I think that's in part what a CRT analysis would be. Would we call out white supremacy, the white supremacist practices that brought people here to build up a country? From the Chinese and Africans were brought here to build a nation that has constantly subordinated them. And so that's, you know, that's what I would hope.
I want to ask you about Kimberly Crenshaw's work in particular and the concept of intersectionality. What does intersectionality mean, and what does it open up for us as scholars or as individuals who are trying to critique systems?
So she was an anti-discrimination lawyer, and she studied kind of, again, and mostly most of the anti-discrimination law is looked at the workplace and at university admissions. And so she was particularly interested in kind of this lawsuit that Black women. There were a group of Black women, but one of them in particular, DeGroffenried, had filed, I think, against GM, that she had been passed over consistently for promotion, and filed a racial discrimination lawsuit. And what the court said was that, well, you can't. She was like, wait a minute, what? And it was, well, you can't, because if Black men are being promoted, it ain't race. If white women are being promoted, it ain't gender. And so what she argued is then you know this term cognizable, that Black women's experiences are not cognizable in the court, in the law. The court can't see it because of how anti-discrimination laws are written. You're either gender or you're race, but you're not both. And what she argued is that no, Black women have had, in this particular instance, a unique experience that can't be explained by what white women experienced and can't be explained by what Black men have experienced. And so there's this intersection of their race and their gender. And that's what she was arguing, is that the courts and US law needs to keep pace with, now that Black women are formally involved in the US labor market, because, you know, we're talking about the post-Brown, most of these laws were written after Brown, and during the 1960s, where Black people were subordinated. So they didn't have labor protections. And so this article was in the early 80s. Now remember, Ronald Reagan kind of erased a lot of the civil rights legal protections and put the burden of proof really on the victim, where you had to prove that they intended to harm you. And so she argued that the U.S. law just hasn't kept pace with how the labor market had changed. And so Black women now make up a unique group. And so that was her basic argument. And she talked about this notion of intersectionality. We had to look intersectionally. We had to look at how people experience things. And she was looking at race and gender. People started adding in other stuff, necessarily so. And we know that we live in the world in complex ways, right? So I'm a woman who's racially ambiguous. At times I'm read as not Black. Sometimes I'm read as Black. What's interesting, my mother is ill. My mother is Japanese American. And recently her doctors have been reading her as Black simply because of me. And so we've had to name, you know, she ain't Black. I'm Black, but my mother is Japanese. And so if you're going to look at her medical history, you have to see her for how she is. She's not me, but by proximity, she's been read as Black. And so there is that's what we're talking about, kind of these intersections of identity and how they may get misread, or how they get read in a way that subordinates, that creates obstacles for opportunities or disadvantages. And so we want to be mindful of how these intersections are acting in that way for young children. So for example, in schools, schools have typically looked at kids who live in single parent families, kids who are on free and reduced lunch. That's an intersection right there that we never actually take into consideration in a way that is meaningful, but we list it as an identity marker. But
when you think about the future of CRT, it's now been put through the fire, so to speak. I think more of the country and the world is aware of CRT than was before, which I think is a good thing. Mm-hmm. How would you encourage scholars going forward? What do you see as the directions that need to be taken up and the questions that need to be taken up? And then alternatively, for individuals who aren't necessarily scholars, but who are perhaps advocates in their context, how would you encourage them to take up CRT?
Well, I think there are some things that people have to be deeply committed to ideologically if they're going to engage with CRT. So this is my beef, even with scholars who kind of, I'm just going to use it as an analytical tool. One, you have to accept that race is, as Derrick Bell would say, it's permanent in the U.S. This is what it is. It's been here. It's always been here. We're over 300 years old. It ain't going nowhere. I mean, look at the moment that we're in, right? And so we have to accept that race and racism are normal, natural, and endemic to how we operate in the U.S. That doesn't mean we don't fight. It just means that's the context. So if you don't know the context, how are you operating? So you understand that context, that people who've experienced inequality get to have a voice. They have a story. They have a perspective. I am challenged a little bit with quant crit because I haven't read enough to know how they're kind of engaging in the stories, which I think are particularly important. And, you know, as a lawyer, I mean, the narrative, you come up with a narrative. If you're a litigator, you come up with a narrative. A witness that gets on the stand, their narrative matters. And so we can't extract out the narrative. So I think we have to keep telling our stories. We have to situate those stories and make sure that they help us understand what's actually happening. So I think people get to be a witness to their experiences, but also help me understand how your particular witness tells us about bigger things that are happening, right? And I think that we just have to stand flat-footed and tell the truth. And so I think folks are afraid. And the concern always has been is as CRT gets taken up in the academy, it will go the way of a lot of things that started out critical and radical and get watered down, become an analytical tool. So I'm going to talk about race and I'm going to use CRT. And yet there's no real critical or transformative discussion about race and what's new. So I would hope that people won't shy away from calling out white supremacy. I also hope that folks who want to take up CRT will speak up in wherever they are. It's easy to write an article. It's harder to do it in your department, right? We have, just the academy in general, there are a lot of radical people in publication, but then they go back and they're very institutionalized. And that doesn't help the cause at all. It doesn't help people get free. You getting a sabbatical for being quiet doesn't help somebody get free. So I always tell my students when I teach the critical race theory class, you don't have to run out and call yourself a critical race theory scholar anymore. Just because you take the class, one, you're not, and you don't have to be. So you can take this and I've read this and you know what? It doesn't align with me. But I would argue that all the early architects, Gloria and other I would say us second and third wave scholars, it is the way we see the world and it's the way we operate. And so if it ain't for you, it ain't for you. You don't have to do CRT. You don't have to. So don't. If it's not, like I said, you have to recognize the race is here. It's real. And it probably ain't going nowhere. That doesn't mean we can't organize. We can't agitate. We can't, try to think of something new. But that is what America is, and you have to understand that.
Thank you, Dr. Dixon, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu.